Hey, what's up, podcast fans? It's Wilson.
And LaCase.
Yes, with me today is a new slash familiar voice. For fans of the show and our Power of You in Fiction series, you may all remember LaCase's voice being featured prominently in our Blurt of the Midwest episode.
Yep, yep.
Yeah, I'm thrilled to say that LaCase has moved from being a guest and friend of the show to now serving as one of our co-hosts.
Yes, and I am super excited to be part of the team and very pumped that I get to start off with a project focusing on women and their contributions to comic books and entertainment at large.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Our podcast team will be spending the month of March, which is Women's History Month. For those who weren't hip, gotta get hip with it, highlighting some awesome real life and fictional women in entertainment through our special called On Their Own Terms, The Unbreakable Women of Media.
It's an analysis of the ways women have redefined and defied society's expectations.
I gotta admit, that's a killer tagline, yo.
Absolutely. I love it so much. It's great.
Yeah. So throughout the month, we'll be releasing a mix of interviews, character analysis, and blog posts. Yeah, we gonna be writing, y'all. We gonna be writing. And we're excited to start off our special with a previously recorded interview of Ann Bean from Emerald Comics Distro, one of our faves.
Yes, we stan Ann. She's the bomb.
Yeah, we do. We do. We hope y'all enjoy this episode and keep coming back for more content for this here Women's History Month.
Bye!
What's going on, podcast fans, podcast listeners? So this is Wilson, and on the other side, it is not Lou. I actually have my co-host for our Women's History Month special, LaCase Perry.
Hey, how's it going?
And with us as one of our Women's History Month special guest is Ann Bean of Emerald Comics, friend of the show. We all love Ann.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So yeah, so for the next 45 minutes to an hour or so, you all will be listening to us talk to Anne about, you know, Emerald Comics update and also just the general theme that we have for Women's History Month of celebrating prominent women in the comic book industry and how they have kind of found a way to reclaim independence and tell stories or even provide the avenue for stories to be told that allow them to speak their truth. So generally what we do, if Lou was on the other side of the mic, I would toss it over to him and he would open us up with questions. And I'm going to kind of do the same thing.
Yeah.
And toss it over to LaCase.
Let's do it.
So she can open up with any question. So go ahead.
Absolutely. Well, this is my first time getting to speak with Anne. Very excited. I've done some research. About Emerald, it's such a cool project distributing indie comics. I think it's definitely an underserved market. So my first question to Anne would be, starting out in something like this is never easy. I can't imagine it was easy. So I was just wondering, what was your support system like to begin Emerald Comics?
That is a great question and one that doesn't get asked often enough, honestly, because I think we have this mentality of like entrepreneurship, which like means that you're Batman, i.e. wealthy, white, and with a large cave of toys.
definitely.
And I'm not saying I don't have some privileges coming into this because I definitely do, but in terms of support system, I meet weekly with a group of other small business owners and we're kind of eclectic. There's an owner of a coffee shop, a music teacher / freelance musician and a henna artist.
Oh, cool.
And we hang out once a week and talk about mostly marketing. But also just like whatever challenges we're dealing with. And they were pretty instrumental in terms of backup support as I was starting. I also sought out a couple of other mentory type people.
Mm-hmm.
I would say another major support specifically for what I'm doing was the comic shop owners.
Yeah.
There were a few that I knew pretty well. and also ones that I like didn't know that well, but they were really positive and enthusiastic about what I was doing. And they continued to, you know, for the most part, the sales part of the job, which is not my necessarily my forte or favorite thing, came easier because I was talking about something I loved with people who seemed like reasonable human beings or who I knew pretty well.
Okay.
And in general, shop owners continuing to be enthusiastic about buying indie comics from me is the only thing that's really keeping my business afloat, because that's my gig, is getting this these comics into stores. I have a supportive spouse who was fine with me doing this thing and didn't mind me dragging in boxes upon boxes of books into our basement.
That's huge. That's fabulous.
Yeah. And I always make sure to like check in and maintain a few friendships that have nothing to do with my work or my hobbies.
Oh,
like,
that's
just
smart. Yeah.
Old friends who I know from another context who like have a bigger sense of me as a person than like the person that does this one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And making sure that like I'm maintaining my relationships with them so that they can, I mean, and most of the time they are old friends from like high school or college who are like big cheerleaders, because they're like, look at you, you did the business thing. And it's one step easier to like ignore my own imposter syndrome, because I'm hearing it from them and they know me.
Yeah.
It's not like I can't do the thing where I'm like, oh, I fooled another person.
Right. Yeah, that is awesome.
That is awesome.
So when we so speaking of that balance, basically the friends that allow you to check in with them and, you know, let your hair down, figuratively speaking, what are those activities, you know, that you do to create that balance? Is it just conversations, or is it something that you can, that's like tactile?
I would say it's mostly just conversations and making sure that like I'm, as someone who, you know, works from home, that I'm like leaving the house and intentionally going and hanging out with people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm introverted, so like my neutral state is like hermit. You know, making sure that I'm paying attention to my friends' lives enough so that I'm not just the sort of, you know, wild-haired, wild-eyed person that like leaves the house twice a month to freak out about their business at you and then runs away again. Like,
oh, sure. Yeah.
Attempting to have some kind of balance in my life, or like go do an activity that has nothing to do with anything, go to karaoke, you know, something that isn't a comics hangout. That being said, I also really enjoy making pretend coworkers, as in like inviting my other writer friends to come write with me. I have a couple of both that group that I talked about before, the marketing group, and with one of my poet friends on more of a like writing level. Once a month we meet and talk about, and this is not like, this is definitely directly related to Emerald and business and all of that stuff, but we have a meeting that I call Business Feelings. And it's based on an outline that I heard about from Lucy Bellwood and Dylan McConis. And it's three things to check in about. What did you do over the last month? What are your challenges right now? And what are your goals for the next month? And I've been doing that meeting like twice a month with, you know, two different groups of folks, for the past, I don't know, 6 months or so, and it's really helpful.
Oh, that's great. I love that idea, because it's so easy, I think, when you're a creative person, especially, to get that tunnel vision, and you like, you want to get that project done, so you're not checking in on yourself, you're not taking off the blinders, and it's easy for your, I think your work can suffer, when that happens. So I think that's a really great idea for anybody who wants to be creative to, apply. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a really helpful practice for me, both in terms of Emerald and in terms of, you know, tracking, like what did I do this month? How many shops did I get around to? I don't remember. Here we go. Yeah. To my personal life as a writer where, you know, yeah, some months I really haven't done a lot of writing, and that's been good to check in with myself and like look realistically at it. And then sometimes I feel like I haven't, you know, done anything, and I look back and I'm like, oh, actually, here's the physical evidence in the notebook, or like, here's the, yeah, I actually did these things. Okay.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's great. Wonderful. That's great.
And so now, Anne, you mentioned Lucy Bellwood, and I got the opportunity, and I'd say privilege to read the 100 Demon Dialogue.
Oh yeah.
And it was phenomenal. I love it. Yeah.
Like, I'm glad you got that. It's such a good book, and I feel like it's applicable to everyone in some capacity, because we do all have like this inner critic that, you know, may or may not have sway over us at various times, but like it's there.
Oh, absolutely. It keeps you from, I don't know, I think it keeps you from appreciating your goals and maybe taking on new goals when you have that voice that's like, you're not really going to do anything great. So mm-hmm. I think it's good that you have that. I was wondering, okay, sorry, I'm kind of circling back, but we will go ahead. Talking about mentors, are you working toward taking on mentees to like learn more about distribution?
At the moment, no. And that's a time issue more than anything. What I need is to make some – I was doing an analysis this morning, actually. I need to make some of my systems a little smoother.
Oh, sure.
So that they take less time, and so that I can get, like, one step closer to – basically, there's a certain amount of help that I need, and I need to contract folks for – it's not like I can afford an employee.
Oh, yeah.
But I have about, you know, 6 to 10 hours per month that, like, I actually really need, because that's 6 to 10 hours that's just gonna gum up the works if it's all me doing it.
Yeah.
And I do contract at this point probably about half of that time. It's stuff like – if I hire someone to help me do a full inventory, it is like so much faster, and I don't feel like I've been run over by a truck at the end of it.
Oh, sure.
But you're talking about mentees. I do genially answer some questions that people send me, because sometimes people are like, what are even my options? I haven't had anyone come to me being like, teach me how to do what you do. Most people are like, oh, thank God, someone's doing that. That is not me. And I occasionally, I have very like brief conversations with like Avi that runs Silver Sprocket about twice a year at a con. We're like, you're doing the thing. Good job. Okay, bye. And Silver Sprocket like works like a record label, so they're a publisher and a distributor. And all of the other distros are like slightly different than me, but same but different. I don't know. And I haven't talked too much to them. There's probably 6 or 7. There's more zine distros than there are comics distros. But it's definitely like we're aware of each other's existence, and we did one sort of group ad in the Comics Journal.
Okay.
That's a thing. I don't know. And I definitely like look at their, you know, shipping policies or wholesale policies to be like, is there an industry standard between the six of us? Maybe. because a thing that I've been working on this fall is making a wholesale and retail site so you can actually buy Emerald Comics on the internet.
Hey,
hooray.
There you go.
Yeah.
So that's up. It doesn't have its full, like, I don't have all the books that need to be up there on it yet, but the start of it is there. Hooray.
That's
awesome.
Yeah. I mean, if you could find somebody who was interested in learning how to do distro. I don't know. It feels a little like funny because I'm like, well, I just made it up. So, but that's also sort of not true. Cause like, I did call the last gasp guy and I did talk to a lot of mostly creators. Uh-huh. But it's just such a small, industry that there's not a lot of people in it. So it's kind of funny to think of mentorship. The thing that I'm pretty enthusiastic about is helping cartoonists like make their products a little more marketable.
Oh, that's great.
That's little stuff like telling people that are making minis to put a cover price on it. Cause that's like the number one retailer complaint, put a cover price on it. And you know, so I don't like attempt to mentor any of my clients because they know what they're doing. And if they don't, then like, I'll tell them to put a cover price on it. Like, seriously, put a cover price on it. But I haven't done much with it in part because, and this is late stage capitalism speaking, but I would want to monetize it. Mm-hmm. And in part, for the most part, like doing a podcast, fine, whatever. If I'm not going to necessarily spend 10 hours teaching one person to do a thing unless we have some kind of a relationship. And honestly, time.
Sure.
Yeah.
And demand. I don't know what people want.
Yeah. Well, and
absolutely.
It's definitely a job or a career that I had, you know, no understanding of until I met Wilson. He told me about you and I did more research. You know, it's something that we really don't talk about, the behind the scenes, factors that go into what we love.
Yeah. And like, as much as Indie Comics Distro is kind of this weird, ridiculous labor of love that I'm like, hey, career, there's a huge distribution industry that's out there. And I'm mostly talking about book market more so than Diamond, but like, it's a thing that has to happen. I mean, distribution is a more abstract concept, is how Amazon became such a ubiquitous retailer is because they got super good at distribution.
Yeah, true.
And I think, I don't know, I still have hopes that book market distribution will eat more and more of the comics industry, or that the comics industry will start as a whole, or the direct market will go, huh, yeah, I guess we are all being outsold by Raina Telegmeier. Scholastic does sell, like, more than DC. Okay.
Let's start to pivot and see what we can, what we can do to actually, exactly. See where it goes and what we can do to actually adapt with the times.
Yeah,
so that's really cool. So you said the put a cover price on it a couple times now. it seems so like pedestrian or like a kind of like a to be expected as a consumer. But is that a thing that a lot of creators just kind of forget to do when they finish their work?
Yes, and myself included. I released like 3 books without cover prices and then figured it out finally. And I think part of it is because like on the like mini comic zine level, sometimes people choose not to put a cover price on something because they're going to sell it at a variety of prices, depending on the venue, especially like zines and things. But more often people are like, hey, I made this thing. I thought about the, you know, what I wanted the cover to look like. I didn't think about capitalism while I was designing the cover. Here we go. Or just
that makes sense.
Didn't think it was important because they were going to be selling it at a zine fair and it's going to have a price tag right next to it. So everyone knows how much it is, and not thinking about like, oh, if this goes to, you know, a gallery or a comic shop or a bookstore, they're going to have to, you know, they're going to have to know. Some bookstores will put their own barcode on everything they get in, even when it's like a handmade zine. Some will put a cover price on, but some will not, and then just be confused. If they, you know, if it doesn't come up in the system like it's supposed to, then they're like, ugh, I don't know. Or in general, I know that, shops are a lot happier to, it's not that they won't take stuff without cover prices, but they're a lot happier when it's like one step less for them to do.
That makes sense. Those little things you don't even think about until like you're in the world. I take it so for granted. I don't even look at that stuff. I'm just like, oh, okay, there's the price.
Yeah.
Right.
As a consumer, we're just, they're like, okay, cool, this is the cost of this thing. Mm-hmm. Put it in my bag. And let's keep going.
Yeah. And, you know, if we're selling stuff on the internet, we don't have to think about putting a sticker on it.
Oh, very true.
Because it's on an online store.
Yep. Yeah.
So you can get that nice look of the, you know, perfectly designed cover that doesn't have extra numbers on it anywhere. But
yeah, true.
Yeah. So, yeah, let's see. I think the other question that I had as we were working through this all was talked about the cover prize, and then we talked about mentors. Okay, bringing it back to just kind of like the having this space, right? So having this distribution space and seeing that there was, I guess, a need in some way of filling it for indie distribution. Was it more, if we can unpack it a little bit, was it more, okay, there is a need and I think I can fill this need, or was it like, oh, maybe I can fill the need? I guess, what was the original impetus for you?
I mean, it was me seeing a need, and I wasn't sure what shape the business was going to be at first. I thought I might just do fulfillment for people in that sort of, and it was kind of like, okay, what resources do I have? What can I do with it? The original, like, I was like, well, I live just a couple of blocks from a post office and I have a basement and a car. What can I do with that? A basement, a car, and a willingness to, you know, sink a bunch of time into this, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And it was after my research process that I realized that, like, the need, because I was trying to figure out what the need was. And the need was, like, a connection between retail outlets and creators. Because of the folks that I talked to, not a ton of them were really diligent about, like, going around and making sure, you know, their books were in shops. And I knew from my own experience that it was a huge pain in the butt to try to keep track of all of that stuff, especially if you've got two books and, you know, realistic life here, you're going to sell like a half a dozen of them a year. Like, that's a huge pain to keep track of. And even if you have a really good run where, like, you sell a dozen in a month because you did a book release, like, maintaining that for the rest of the year is a pain. Or following the eternal following up with stuff. You know, having self-published a novel way back in the day that I then consigned at some bookstores that, like, never paid me, and then I didn't bother them enough to get them to pay me, and then I was like, wait, what am I doing? This is terrible. I'm kind of glad I had that experience so that I can be like, ah, okay, as a business person now, I am helping people avoid that experience. And honestly, it does help the shops, because one point of contact instead of 50 points of contact is really useful.
Oh, true.
Especially for consignment-based shops.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have a quick follow-up question. Okay, so you said that you saw the need. So you went for it. I noticed with a lot of the people I admire, particularly women, it's kind of, I hear that story a lot, you know, like, okay, got to do it for myself. You know, no one's going to help me do it. I just got to go out and get it done. But I've also seen with a lot of their stories that when they do it and they're making it happen, it seems like because for whatever reason, you don't fit that mold, like you're not a straight white guy, people try to kind of obstruct your process. So I was wondering if you had experienced any of that, like people trying to derail you, or have you been underestimated because you don't fit that mold?
I think the most, like, underestimation I get is from folks who are like, you do what? Wait. I'm I feel really lucky in the Pacific Northwest because for the most part, I get along well with I'm the sort of person who just likes people.
Oh, yeah.
But I get along well with 90% of the comic owners. And there's a few that I kind of have a more brusque business-like relationship with. And yeah, I probably end up selling less comics to them. But no one has been a total asshole to me. No one has, no one has done the maybe it's because the pool of people I deal with is so comparatively limited that I think I've shielded myself from a lot of the grander crap that could well be thrown my way. I'm not going to lie, I do sort of live in fear of getting comics gated.
Yeah. That's a realistic fear, honestly. That was insane.
That's a real realistic fear. That was a factor, not the root cause, perhaps, but a factor in a local comic shop closing.
Oh,
which sucked.
Yeah.
One of the ones that I was selling comics to.
Ugh.
Oh, wow.
So that's that's sort of Damocles hanging over my head, but the actual people that I deal with on a regular basis are so lovely, and I get maybe the occasional standoffishness, but nothing rude, nothing mansplainy. And I think part of that is because the indie comics world is big, and a lot of times the people who are coming to me see what I'm doing and are interested in it, or send me an email trying to get me to hire them, and then I'm like, I'm not hiring anyone. And they're like, okay. And I know things will change as I start working with more and more people. I really am getting to that tipping point where I'm like, okay, at some point we got to figure out how to make enough money to get that part-time employee, because this is too much for a human.
It's a lot.
I've been incredibly lucky. And part of it, I'm sure, helps that I'm a kind of unassuming white woman who's hey, and that, again, the Pacific Northwest comic shop owners are really lovely people. Most of them are pleasant and would, there's not a shop up here except for maybe one that I don't sell directly to that was just weird, and they mostly sell back issues. the fact that, I'm thinking, Portland and Washington, and I can think of one comic shop where I'm like, I felt weird being in there.
Okay.
Oh. The rest of them I have felt quite welcome. And I also, there's a couple that definitely kind of have the vibe of, old school comic shop, as in if I were brand new to comics, I would be a little overwhelmed. But the fact that those are relatively few and far between is great. I'm the sort of person that you get to know the name of the owner, and you ask the owner what they like, and if they're not, and even some of the most sort of comic book guy type shops, if you get to know the person, and they're not a jerk to you, then it's fine. I think it might help that the comic shop, my first actual comic shop, which was in Colorado Springs, Colorado, was in many ways a super stereotypical, there was the old guy that, knew all the things, and he was in the process of passing it along to the new guy, and they're both white guys. New guy, kind of reminiscent of comic book guy from The Simpsons. not as annoying of a voice, but
that's good.
But thankfully, despite appearances, they were at least, I didn't know old guy that well, but they were good enough to be kind to the floppy little college freshman that's wandering in looking for back issues of Sandman.
Good one.
I don't know. I think I've always been so invested in the, the medium that I'm willing to blast past a certain level of bullshit. That being said, I have been offered really shockingly little bullshit.
That gives me hope.
And
it gives me a lot of hope.
Yeah, I think part of it is because I have the branding around me.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why I haven't necessarily had wider bullshit. It's not like, right, Anne Bean, this one woman, or as so the last con of the year I did was down in Tacoma, and it's a small con, and like it's in a bookstore. There's a dozen tables. It's more of like a zine fest type of thing.
Okay.
And I hear from somewhere up front in the bookstore, someone being like, "Oh, there's this girl back there that distributes comics."
super reductive, but okay.
Yeah.
One of my clients was also tabling there, and they were like, "And when did you stop being an adult?"
There's a little gal on the back.
What distributes fans into comics? Yep.
Thank you, sir.
I want to check her out. Yeah.
Because publicly I'm Emerald Comics Distro.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, you have to go to my website and click the about page to even see the face of the person that's behind it. I think that helps.
Yeah. Yeah. You have that air of professionalism. I think that definitely does help. But yeah, that gives me a lot of hope hearing that you don't have to go through all this, like, just unmitigated crap that I do see in a lot of the wider fields.
Yeah, and again, goodness knows I'm going to get comic skated at some point, like when they notice me. But hopefully I can weather that storm.
Yeah, seriously, we'll have your back. We will defend you till the end.
Absolutely.
You know.
Two-factor authentication on all devices.
Yeah, that's
scary.
Standard operating procedure nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
Huh?
And I think it helps that I know people who have gone through, not necessarily exactly comic skating. I mean, I do know people who have gone through comic skating and it sucked.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I know people who have done cool projects, mm-hmm, and gotten a lot of hate for them.
Oh, that's a shame.
Like, my friend Natasha Marin did the Reparations Project, or continues to do the Reparations Project, which is amazing. And it's mostly off of a hub of a Facebook page, but there's also a website, reparations.me, and it connects people of color who have requests, and anybody who has offerings to connect up, and like everything from like money to career advice to stuff. It's a really fascinating hub.
Yeah.
And she got a ton of press about it, which was great because she got a ton of press about it, uh-huh, but also terrible because she got a ton of hate for it. And you can imagine all the reasons why. Like, because, hey, we're still in a white supremacist country that has a very hard time with anything connected to even the beginning of a concept of reparations.
Yeah.
Even to have a conversation about it.
Oh, my gosh.
Elicits the most vehement responses.
It is.
Times. And it's like, we're just trying to talk about this thing. You know, it's, mm-hmm, one of those things where it's like, we haven't even put any quote unquote actionable plans, mm-hmm, in order. It's just, mm-hmm, like, hey, how about we have a dialogue?
Yeah.
No. 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 Like, okay, I guess you don't want to have a conversation?
Yeah.
Fine.
But, yeah. Anyway, seeing how she has weathered her trolls and continues to maintain a rather delightful troll fund where people can donate, and then for every trollish message she gets, she puts a dollar towards people's requests.
Hey, that's great.
Oh, wow.
Right?
That is so clever. Wow. Impressive. I gotta say, I wouldn't have even thought about that. That's one of those things where, you know, kind of like, I would say like receiving the negative and then, mm-hmm, transferring it into positive.
Oh, yeah.
Nice little alchemist
brilliant
kind of movement.
That is, mm-hmm, a great idea. It takes away their power in a way too. I mean, like, who's going to want to troll when it's giving someone else money?
Yeah, exactly. And they're like, ah, dang it. Yes. Like, ah, you're
strike
still
me
winning.
Down and you shall make me more powerful, etc.
Right. Yeah. That's pretty awesome.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. And you said her name was Natasha.
Natasha Marin.
Marin.
Her, let's see. I think it's reparations.me is the site.
Definitely awesome. Gonna look into that.
We're gonna look into it, and we're gonna drop it in our in the podcast description for the episode so that listeners can, you know, check it out themselves.
Yeah, fight the trolls.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Sweet. So as you bringing it back still with the entire, you know, considering this avenue that we're on with the you being lucky to not encounter a lot of the, you know, a lot of the obstructions and just a lot of the white male supremacist ideologies when it comes to, you know, an industry that's supposed to really celebrate all people. When it comes to like your allies, when you, you know, you, when you said your friend was like, I don't remember you becoming a child, and you know, you're like, how has that, you know, like, how has that experience helped you navigate through and even potentially help you like promote other individuals who may be a bit more gun shy or reluctant to share their piece, you know, knowing that there is a strong ally system?
I mean, that's a always been a big deal to me. And like when I think about what my catalog has evolved into, it's a little more coherent than it was in the beginning, but it's still pretty eclectic. Part of my commitment is to make sure that I am not only, you know, looking at submissions, but that I'm soliciting people and that I'm making sure to keep a strong, representation of like authors and characters of color, queer authors and characters, trans authors and characters. I sort of incidentally picked up a, I think about 10% of my clients are, trans or non-binary. I'm like, oh, okay.
Oh, that's awesome.
Let's keep that up. I mean, and a little bit of that is capitalism because when you have, a group of stuff, like I have great comics for trans teens. Mm-hmm. Awesome. That's super saleable to like a specific group of people, trans teens and all of their relatives that are trying to buy them a Christmas present. Like, it's great. But on the other half, it really is a community thing in terms of like both wanting to bolster the voices of people that I think are interesting and cool. And whose voices should be bolstered, and also so that there is, I mean, here we are, the power of you in business, so that people can see, on shelves, you know, work by people that are in the same demographics as them, or work by people whose work they connect with in ways that they might not connect with other stuff. And, you know, I do have clients that like, hate tabling at zine fairs because they're really socially anxious, and I feel really happy about being able to get more of their books into the world than they would be able to comfortably do on their own.
Oh yeah, that's great.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's the. And while I've been thinking about it, every time I think about Emerald Comics, to be honest, that was kind of, I think that might be the last thing in my head where it's like, you do have amazing creators who may be socially anxious, and they may have, you know, any kind of anxiety, and you being that platform for them is such a relief. And I was like, so yeah, you bringing it up right now is like, wow, I kind of forgot like that could be a thing.
And it's hard to pitch your own work. I think it's a skill that all artists need to develop, but I at this same this zine fair in Tacoma where like I think half the people there were my clients, but it was great. I got to introduce them to each other. Hooray!
Right.
But you know, I was to some of them, I was pitching other people's books at them, or being like, "Hey, here's what this is about," and they're like, "Oh, you know, you've gotten really good at pitching." I'm like, "Yeah, because I have to do it for like hundreds of things." And, you know, one of them was like, oh. So sometimes I talk to people about how they pitch their stuff so that I can do better. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes people are like, how do you pitch my stuff? Cause I suck at pitching it and, you know, I want to do better. It's a little easier to, be super enthusiastic about your friend's work than yours. That's not to say that I'm like personally friends with each one of my clients, but it's that principle, that principle of like, I guess that's like a bonus, for my own artistic career that I've gotten out of this is being able to figure out a quick pitch. I forget what we were talking about. It probably wasn't pitching.
Well, it was along the lines of pitching.
It was. Well, I was wondering, it sounds almost like, you know, by bringing, maybe not all the time, but at the Tacoma Zine Fair, you had all these people together. Do you think that this could turn into like a Skillshare situation, like where you have your creators working together on projects?
I mean, that's more up to them than it is to me. That being, I'm thinking about like, when do I have requests to like tap into my creator pool? Sometimes there's like we have an extra booth at this con. Can you ask your people if they want it? Or like, we're looking to run, and this is more like shops saying, like, we're looking to run events. Can you ask people who have books coming out next year to get in touch with us? That kind of thing. I would say a lot of my clients who are in the active market to do collaborations are pretty good at that on their own.
Okay.
Like, I have quite a lot of clients that are – that do it all themselves. They're the writer, the drawer, all of the things, like your full service cartoonists who, you know, do their own book design and everything. I also have clients that like one is also a book designer. And actually they designed, some of the books of one of my other clients. So that was exciting. And then I have a couple of clients who write usually a whole line of comics and then work with a whole bunch of different artists to draw them. And this is, I mean,
oh, wow.
A couple, there's Miles Greb who, writes a comic called After the Gold Rush, which is a optimistic science fiction set, in the far future. And also he's also done a mythic story called Espers and, story set in, about 10,000 BC called Clovis. That's about a member of the Clovis people as searches for her lost son. But he works with a bunch of different artists. Likewise, Arledge Comics is the brand, of comics. I think they're all at this point written by Jen Arledge. And then drawn by a wide variety of folks. And Jen's really good at, I see them posting like hiring calls on Twitter pretty frequently. And I'm sure they do in other places as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, and Arledge Comics publishes like, there's, a lot of kind of teen to adult ones, a delightful series called Alex Priest Vampire Hunter, which is about a genderqueer vampire who is forced to team up with their ex, and they work for rival vampire hunting agencies, one of which is like a very for-profit headhunter-y type of place, and one which is like a non-profit vampire hunting agency that's like, no, this is like what we do for the good of humanity, right?
I'm very here for that story. That would be great.
Right? And many others as well. So, like, most of the people that I work with are really consummate professionals who, for one reason or another, and a lot of times it is because they're, like, halfway split between book marketing, the world of the books without the pictures, and then comics, like Rosarium Publishing, which, like, has all of their stuff in Baker & Taylor and Ingram. I'm not sure if they have their comics there. Because they publish both fiction and comics as a press. And having been part of a small poetry publisher, I know that for small publishers, sometimes it's easy to slip through the cracks if you're not making stuff frequently enough to get picked up by a larger distributor. So.
Okay.
but most of my folks are pretty well know what they're doing. And, you know, some folks who are like, oh, I just did a mini and I guess I'll carry it with you. They're figuring it out.
Okay.
So I don't know how much crossover between clients will happen. And I've been thinking, like, do I want to try to, like, get all of my clients in a pile at Emerald City and, like, introduce them all to each other? Yeah, maybe.
That'd be kind of fun. You never know what could come out of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, it always delights me when they meet each other and are fans of each other's work.
Yeah.
Oh, that is wonderful. Let's see. Doing a quick time check. We've got, I'd say, 15 to 20 minutes left.
Okay.
Of conversation time, being able to talk about the support system, the community of allyship. Let's see, what else would we want to tackle in our time remaining? While we're, you know, just like that covers what we're focusing on in Women's History Month.
Can I talk about Jackie Orms a little bit?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Oh, please do.
I
wanted to talk about her because at some point as like when I was getting into writing comics and I was like, yeah, comics writing, this is great. I went back to look for, like who are my ancestors in a like comics writing community mm-hmm. women since,
mm-hmm. Right.
And I looked at like early women who were making comics and of course, Jackie Orms came up and, for listeners who may not be familiar with her, she published comics in, she was the first black woman mm-hmm. to have comics syndicated in a newspaper. She published comics in the late 30s and then a whole bunch in the 50s. And they were like pretty punk. I'm into
yeah.
them.
She's an icon. She's fabulous.
Yeah. She did some that were like kind of biting political commentary, but in kind mm-hmm. of a single gag. And then she had like some really rad adventure comics that would like come with little paper dolls, a series called Torchy Brown. Because I was already a fan of her to begin with, I was delighted. One of the series that I carry is called Super Butch, and it is set in a fictional city that I don't know, feels kind of like Chicago, but a fictional city in the 40s.
Okay.
And it's about a woman who passes for white at work, passes for straight at home, spends
yeah.
the rest of the time not at work or at home at lesbian bars. And there are superheroes that work for the cops. They're busting the lesbian bars. There are superheroes that are on the side of the lesbians who are fighting the like city mandated superheroes. It's a great series. But in the third issue, Jackie Orms shows up as just like a side character at a house party. And
nice.
That made my day.
Yes.
I thought that was great.
I love that.
That's pretty awesome.
I'll have to check that out for sure. That sounds so cool.
Here's my mandated capitalism to double check. I believe I have that up on the website right now.
Hey, now.
Hey. Awesome.
Yes.
Synergy.
There you go.
You can buy it.
There you go,
at
folks.
EmeraldComicsDistro.com.
Get it. Get it while it's hot. I'll be grabbing it. Well, and just talking about, you know, the Queen Jackie and, you know, yourself as well, being able to make it, finding your own path. I mean, she did
yeah.
something remarkable at a time when women, especially black women and other women of color, like that probably wasn't even like a possibility to a lot of people. So my question is, what do you think women really have to be able to do, or what's a resource you think that they need to make these things happen for themselves?
I would say to not assume that the status quo is like a life sentence, like to not necessarily take what has been presented as truth, and also to like do actual research about what the industry actually is, because like I was, you know, when I mentioned Raina Telegmeier earlier,
mm-hmm.
Like if you look at raw sales data, yes, actually middle grade graphic novels are outselling a lot of the rest of the comics industry. Mm. And, you know, that's not to say that if middle grade graphic novels aren't your jam, like, that's fine. You can go find something else to do. But not taking the voices that say, like, this is a man's game, mm. or that, well, you know, men control all the most important editorial positions. So, which it's not true. Look at Karen Berger. She has her own imprint now, Berger mm-hmm. Comics. Mm-hmm. Boom. And I don't know. I find it really heartening to do research to remind yourself that women have always been there.
Mm-hmm.
And they've always been doing something. It's just that they're not necessarily getting the press. Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes they did get the press, but like that you do have people who have come before you.
Yeah.
Like, I get everybody's point when they were like, Batwoman's girlfriend is the first trans woman character and whatever. It's not true mm-hmm. because there have been many before.
Yeah.
One of my favorites being Coagula out of Doom Patrol in the 90s when Rachel Pollack was writing it. Rachel Pollack, by the way, wrote for DC Comics for quite a while, and was one of my mentors in college, in grad school.
Oh, fabulous.
And I had one lovely day where I was tabling with her to promote my grad school program, Goddard College, at MoCA a few years ago. And we just got to, like, chat, mm-hmm. and it was really fascinating to, like, see her, you know, talk to other DC people occasionally that would mm-hmm. see us at the table and just, like, get her perspective on a lot of things, including kind of comics industry in general. And at some point, like, Ann Nesenti came by and recognized her because they both worked in DC, at a similar time. And, I sassed Ann Nesenti a little bit more than I meant to, but, you know, because I was asking about, like, one of the New 52 Catwoman books that I found mm-hmm. just, like, incredibly exploitative.
Mm-hmm.
Where I was, like, basically I was asking her, did you, and I thought it was her that had written it, and it wasn't even her that wrote it. I feel bad about that.
Oh, no.
But I was basically asking, like, did you write in, basically, the male gaze? Like, did you write in how, like, every frame of the first page is Ooh. Not about her, but about, you know, how we're looking at her.
And
so that didn't go over that well. I was rude. But Rachel had an interesting comment, and bless her heart, she wasn't, like, rude. An interesting comment that, like, some women who were working in Marvel and DC Comics, or at least DC, because that's where she worked and could speak to, mm-hmm. In that, like, funny time period where it was, like, transitioning between, you know, spinner racks to comic shops and, mm-hmm. you know, everything was kind of rebooting itself in the 90s, and how some women felt like they needed to, you know, basically sacrifice feminist ideals in order to have a job.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, you know, that sucks, but that's the reality of how things might have been at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think that I'm not going to say that, you know, if you just have, you know, bootstraps and gumption, it'll happen for you, because that's incredibly privileged mm-hmm. and silly and untrue. I think it's – I would say that, like, you do have ancestors and you do have community.
Mm-hmm.
And it's out there. And my sincerest hope for every creator is that they can find both of those things for themselves, because yeah. that's what's helped me through.
Amen.
Yeah, well said. So thinking of the flip side of it, I guess. So we thinking of the creators that, you know, have been able to blaze trails and create this space of this. I guess I'll say the space of, like, egalitarianism, right? Mm-hmm. Like, essentially, like, forcing the equity to be seen. What are some books that you know, some pieces that you might be reading now or you did read in the past that, you know, that you saw and said, yes, this is a piece of art that speaks truth to power?
Sure. I will talk about a couple of the anthologies that I carry because that's the first thing that came to mind.
Awesome.
And then I can talk more generally about, well, actually, I'm going to sidetrack myself. Here we go. A book that definitely speaks truth to power. I know it's one of the press's bestsellers, but it's a Silver Sprocket book. It's Ben Passmore's, oh my gosh, I'm going to blank on the name, looking it up. It's not Daiglo Ahole, which is his other great, if you like surrealistic fiction. It's Your White Friend and Other Strangers.
Ooh.
Your Black Friend and Other Strangers.
Oh,
there we go.
Your Black Friend and Other Strangers.
There was a little animation that came out. That was from the, Your Black Friend is a short story within it, but, it's a lot of meditation on race and just like taking up space as a Black man.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely, speaks truth to power and also is a good, example of what comics can do specifically to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I feel like he's a master of the medium, both in terms of how he does his paneling and how he does his word balloons, but also like his sense of line and color and everything is really great. In terms of stuff from my catalog, it's always interesting, talking to new shop owners who are like, what are your best sellers? And I'm like, well, I have some that you would expect to be a bestseller, like this cute zine about cats. Everyone loves cats. That's
yeah.
Here we go. But like, yeah, my bestseller that now is like done with its print run and we're going to have to wait until next year when the press can, you know, do another print run is Power and Magic, which is, a bunch of short stories and it's all by, women and non-binary people of color.
Hell yeah.
Women. Nice.
Yeah, I said that. Women and non-binary people of color. Yeah. It's great. It's really, like, beautifully edited. The stories are gorgeously drawn. And in a roundabout way, I'd say that one speaks truth to power. I know power is literally in the title.
Right.
But part of the – I don't know. I'm talking about ancestors and community. And part of the reason I think why – that one speaks to so many people. A, it has a really arresting cover with like, that's very purple. It's this gorgeous, powerful looking Black woman.
Oh, yeah.
But I think some folks are going to see themselves really well reflected in that and sort of like, oh my gosh, I kind of have this witchy community that I didn't know I had. And then I think some people are going to be like, oh, there they are. There's my folks. They're published. And some people are going to be like, oh, witchiness is so much bigger than I had in my brain.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that one. I really like, of all of my clients, a person that speaks very gently yet powerfully to power, is mm-hmm. Christina Tran. Her work is really lovely and meditative and fascinating. I carry a zine of hers called, Things I Cannot Say, which is, it's diary comics, but it's, and it's somewhat reflecting on race. It's somewhat reflecting on politics mm-hmm. and like how to exist in a very fraught political time when, as like a quiet, gentle person.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a good one.
In a way that like still has any kind of effect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That spoke directly to me. I'm going to pick that up.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I love that.
Her website is sodelightful.com and is also well worth checking out because she has a bunch of work up there. She does cool ongoing projects. Like I think her current one is, I don't know if she's stopped doing this yet, but Dear Beloved, which when she's at con, she'll have paper out that says Dear Beloved across the top, and you're to write like something kind and affirming that you need to hear, put it in a bowl, and then pick another one from the bowl that somebody else has written a kind affirming thing on.
Oh, wow. I love that.
She also, she has a zine called Dear Daughter, which is like her, it has a bunch of pictures from her family, and it's, I believe it's after her mother's death, but she is writing kind of a long form meditation on like motherhood and daughterhood and like letters mm-hmm. to her hypothetical future daughter. Anyway, her stuff is great. Feel like it's powerful, but not in a like, you know, big screaming way, but in a like quiet, gentle way, which I love.
Yeah. You need that balance, I think, mm-hmm. sometimes. Not everything has to be super bombastic and in your face. Sometimes it's just mm-hmm. those little things that can make a huge difference. It's beautiful.
I guess along those lines, the last book I'll mention is an anthology that I just recently picked up. The editors are all out of the East Coast. And it's called Boy, I Love You. And it is a boys love comics anthology. And if you're not familiar with the genre, it's... The term comes out of manga, and it's gay, usually gay male romance that doesn't necessarily have sex attached to it.
Okay.
Or, you know, it's not porn. And there's been some titles that are in the genre that are manga that have been really popular this year in the States, like Go For It Nakamura is the name of one of them, which is adorable. It's about a like middle school or high school kid who like has the hugest crush on a boy, and like it seems like he could go for it, and he just like is dealing with his own internal issues in kind of a lighthearted way. It's not like it's his coming out story, and it's not like it's his terrible family. It's like he's just actually a deeply awkward person who doesn't know if his crush will ever like him back and is too afraid to do anything about it, which is kind of refreshing because a lot of queer stories get like shoved into a bunch of kind of like tropes that aren't like inherently the worst, but are kind of the worst because it's like the only stories we hear, like you know, bury your gays, you know, like whenever I find a bisexual male character, I feel amazed. And if I find a bisexual female character who didn't like have some kind of huge tragedy happen to her, it's great.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, can there just be lesbians that just like have a nice time?
Exactly. Seriously.
But that's part of the thing with this Boy, I Love You, which is by Yam Fam Comics, which I love their name.
Name. I love it.
Is that they're just like cute romance short stories. They're super appropriate for teens. Which there's not a ton of like gay romance that's appropriate for teens. Like there's definitely some, but this is a lovely example of it and a lovely example of like, just kind of a fun, gentle book that in some ways is rewriting what queer youth can be, both in terms of like the cute stories that are in it that are usually most of the characters in the stories are like probably in their 20s. So it's mostly young characters, but it's not like kids or teens, like having their first whatever. It's just like kind of in a world where, you know, everything, this is normal and these are cute romances. Because that's helping shape this world into a world where this is normal and cute romances are normal. And that, you know, again, that's the thing with anything representational. It's like, yeah, this is great because gay teens can see this and be like, oh my gosh, there can be just like casual cute romance about me.
Exactly.
But also so that, you know, all teens that like romance can be like, oh, this is a normal way that cute romance is.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's just two people, you know?
Yeah.
It stops mattering.
Yep.
That's
also, it's a gorgeous book, and it's super adorable.
I'm going to have to find that. That sounds really cute. I'm here for it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Ooh. So those are the ones that you carry. Any general ones that you want to mention?
Well, I don't carry Ben Passmore.
Okay, you don't carry
Ben Passmore. That's Silver Sprocket, but that should be pretty easily available.
Oh, okay.
Sweet.
books that have come out this year that I definitely had time to read. Yeah. Honestly, I have not had a ton of time to read, which, aside from submissions, which is not great. I'm finally reading 100,000 Kingdoms now. Speaking of, like, shaking up the fantasy genre and normalizing, like, that fantasy doesn't have to be solely Western European.
Right?
That's, for those who don't know, 100,000 Kingdoms by N.K. Jemisin, which probably came out more than a decade ago. but it's the first part of an epic fantasy series of hers.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's wonderful.
Yeah, she is a force.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, N.K. Jemisin is like your favorite speculative fiction writer's favorite writer.
Yeah.
That's right. How I look at her.
Yeah, it's true. Everyone
oh, yeah, that came out in 2010. I'm super on it.
Better late than never.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. It's like when you, I think, you know, discovering a new book, a new story is also like discovering a band, right? That may have been around since forever, but like, it's your first time and it's always amazing.
Yeah.
I gotta say, I was avoiding, like high fantasy for a long time because I got disillusioned with it. I felt like I was reading the same story again and again, and I hadn't found folks that were really doing something innovative with the genre. And then I read Saladin Ahmed's Throne of the Crescent Moon and was like, oh, right. Fantasy is great.
Yeah,
I forgot. it's just that everyone was writing the same story, and if you write a different story, then it's interesting again.
Yeah.
I had an emotional roller coaster the other day when I heard that G. Willow Wilson is going to be off Ms. Marvel.
Yeah,
but I didn't know that.
Saladin Ahmed's taking over.
Hey now, there we go.
Right. I was like, wait, yes! So I'm really excited to see where he takes the character.
Yeah, that should be really good.
Let's see, look, Case, anything else before we wrap?
Oh my gosh. Oh, we talked about so much and I loved all of it. Let me see if I had any questions.
Uh-huh.
Did I have any questions we didn't hit at? Okay, one final question for me. Do you have any goals that you want to meet for the next year with Emerald Distro?
I mean, honestly, that's going to be part of January is going to be me figuring that out.
Oh, sure.
I've gone through like the initial, like, I'm doing the thing. Okay, cool. and then, you know, did manage to launch a website. One of my goals is like, get the website so that it has the things on it, people know about it, and they're going to use it and buy stuff. which, you know, I haven't done hardly any marketing to speak of, so that hasn't happened yet, but that's okay. That's part of the goal for next year. I also need to figure out how much growth can I handle, and like, what do I want to do when I reach my upper limit? Because like, there is a rapidly approaching upper limit of clients that I can reasonably take on at a time.
Oh, sure.
And there's also like, I need to figure out where, you know, how I can afford a part-time employee. Mm. Where are the most efficient ways to allocate my resources? Mm-hmm. So basically, figuring out how to make this sustainable.
Yeah.
And not just kind of like a mad thing that I'm trying to see if it works. Like, I have many times used the metaphor of like throwing spaghetti at the wall to see what sticks. And like, I've got some of what sticks. I need to just nail down exactly how long I'm cooking that spaghetti. and then figure out, you know, the most efficient way to run the kitchen, basically.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Very fair. Okay, so Lacase took care of the creator question. I'm going to ask you the consumer question. So, what non-Steven Universe series? Because I know your answer would be Steven Universe, not the question I'm asking. Do you believe has handled, I'd say, growth, maturation, and just, normalizing A, the non-binary experience, and also B, just the the woman experience, you know. So what non-Steven Universe series would you say?
To stay within the realm of animated children's programming, I'm going to go She-Ra.
She-Ra, also.
The She-Ra robot. I was hoping you would say She-Ra. Yeah. I was so hoping you would say that.
Yay! Yeah, no, I recently binge-watched that, of course, and loved it. And things that I love about it include that, so original She-Ra was definitely made to sell toys, and therefore the character designs were designed for, like, the two, like, genera male and genera female, like, toy models. So everyone has the same outline. I really appreciated that the character design was, like, all over the place, like, different shapes, different body types, all kinds of folks, you know, different races, different, like, the shape of the character matches the, like, element that they work with, all kinds of just, like, really, really solid character design. I feel like, I mean, it's a very gay show, but it's not explicitly gay, which is fascinating.
Okay.
That's always fun. That's always fun.
Like, there's a generation of children who are going to, like, have their queer awakening looking at, like, Catra at the prom.
Yes.
It's got characters that act in, I suppose, gender nonconforming ways. Like, I love Bo because he is so just, like, helpful and enthusiastic. And, like, he's clearly a badass on his own right. But at the same time, like, you know, he values his friends a lot. And, you know, I appreciate, like, him and Scorpia are probably my favorite characters because they're both just, like, super enthusiastic and goofy. And I love Scorpia's backstory in terms of, like, yeah, I'm a princess. I just didn't really fit in, so I guess I live over here now.
Awesome.
Yeah, I would say, you know, it's only had a season, so it has not – the world building is not as deep as Steven Universe, although I feel like that is hard to do. But I appreciate kids programming shows that have a lot of female characters – and show a bunch of different ways to be a girl.
Yes.
Like, I think that was the strength of My Little Pony Friendship is Magic, is because there were a bunch of different ways to, like, be a girl, even though it was, you know, it was ponies and had a very specific and intense fandom, continues to have a very specific and intense fandom. That's one thing that I really appreciate about that show.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. I love the answer. Great answer. Yep.
Yeah.
Alrighty. So this has been a treat, an absolute delight as always. And
can I tell you a secret Easter egg about She-Ra?
Yeah.
In the prom episode, at some point in one of the crowd scenes, you'll see a couple, and one of them is a woman with short blue hair and I think glasses, and that's Noelle Stevenson, the creator's fiance, Molly Knox Ostertag.
Oh, I love that!
Yeah.
That's a good Easter egg.
Heart melting.
Yes, I'm here for it. Oh, I should have married an artist or creator or television person of some sort.
Immortalize me in adorable cartoons.
Yes.
Oh, that is so cute.
That's beautiful.
I love it.
That's precious. That was a perfect one.
Yay.
Yeah. Wonderful. Wonderful. So sweet. So before we tie a bow on it all, you know, for the good of the order, let our listeners know where they can find your work that you distribute, and, you know, anything else that you want to let them know about Emerald Comics Distro.
Yeah, you can find both the comics that I distribute if you would like to look at them or buy them, and also information about submitting, which is gonna be like mid-January because I gotta catch up on some stuff. You can find all of that at emeraldcomicsdistro.com. That's comics is plural, distro is singular. You can also send me an email if you have questions, if you think I can help you with anything, if you want to know more, at info@emeraldcomicsdistro.com. And if you want to, like, follow along and see what books I'm putting in shops, every time I do a sales meeting, I throw it up on Instagram and on Twitter. On Instagram, I'm Emerald Comics Distro. On Twitter, I'm Emerald Distro.
Awesome.
All right. So It's been a thrill as always, and thanks so much.
Yes.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, so good to meet you, Anne. This is
yeah,
a great,
likewise.
Great conversation.
So, podcast fans, this has been our segment of our Women's History Month special. I hope you all enjoyed it. Let's see, any things that we want to sign off on? Well, yeah, you can reach Wilson, me, myself here, at Word to Wilson on Twitter, and you can reach LaCase.
I am at LaCase Perry on Twitter or at LaCase Face on Instagram if you're feeling
yeah,
kooky.
And of course, you can always check out our website, www.comicidal.net, and you'll find all our happenings, you know, from cons to books that we're reading or shows that we're enjoying and the podcast episodes there. So we appreciate you all and thanks for listening.
Bye. To close out today's podcast, Wilson is going to share a quote we think captures the tone of our conversation.
The beauty of literature is you allow readers to see things through other people's eyes. All good books do this. Sandra Cisneros.